You are listening to the Gay Florida Man Podcast. This podcast is hosted by retired corrections officer Mark DeWolf, who will discuss various topics prevalent to corrections, gay culture, arts and entertainment, as well as current events. Listeners need to be advised that this podcast will discuss situations involving extreme violence, substance abuse, sexual assault, and murder. Details of actual events have been modified so as to protect the privacy of involved parties.
Welcome back to the Gay Florida Man's Podcast. This is episode 51. Mark is off this week, so I'm your host, Alex. And in this episode, we go over three main areas of Mark DeWolf's life. The first one being his career as a corrections officer. The second one being passion for scary movies and prop collecting. And the final one, his passion for film production and acting. Hey, Mark, what's up?
How are you, Alexis?
I am doing good. Good. It's about time we got this podcast started. You know, we've been trying to do it since October.
I'm excited. I'm very excited. I'm glad to be on your show.
Yeah. So the first question I want to ask is, if you had to describe yourself, like, who is Mark DeWolf?
I cannot stand arrogance. And so to describe myself, I would hope that I would see myself through the eyes of others. And I would hope that some of the key words that people might bring up would be, God, I hope funny. And we're not talking about looks here. We're just talking about my sense of humor.
Yeah.
Compassionate, empathetic, sensitive. I think I am a person that is driven and I really enjoy making people laugh. I really enjoy entertaining and I like to bring out the positive emotions in people. A lot of times I like to listen to what other people have to say. I'm not always good at that because I'm a talker. I hope that I take the time to listen to people and hear their stories.
Well, I don't think you have any trouble doing that. I think that the way you describe yourself, I think that's a very good way to describe yourself because that's who you are.
Right. Well, I hope. You tell me. Is that what you see in me?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Very accurate.
All right. Because you've known me for a while now, so.
Yeah, so let's talk about how we met. So I was working at Planet Fitness for a while. That's when we first talked to each other. And I remember the conversation was about Halloween party. And I was with my old boss.
Jeff.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that I thought was cool about Jeff was he would really encourage you guys as employees at the gym to dress up. You did like themes every Halloween, right?
Yeah, we did. I remember, I think it was a contest between the Planet Fitnesses that the owners owned, you know, so we would compete with like the other gyms. And I remember the year before I joined, we had actually won the contest.
Was that the skiing picture that he showed me?
No, the skiing picture, that one was the year that we did it for the time that I was there.
But
the year before that, I think it was prisoners. Cops and robbers, I think. Yeah.
Shocking.
Yeah. And that's the one we won, actually. So
very cool. Were you a cop or were you a robber?
I wasn't working at the time. So I don't.
Oh, you weren't? Okay.
So yeah, I probably would have been a robber, I think.
What?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
I think it's always fun playing the bad guy, you know?
Oh, that's true. That is absolutely true. As far as like my acting background, it's so much more fun to be the bad guy, the character.
Yeah.
To your answer your question about how we met is I remember going in and out of the gym and you were just a very nice guy. A lot of times the people that work there at the gym, they might say hi or good afternoon or whatever, very small talk. You didn't fit the typical gym employee, Alexis. You were very nice and very sincere, very soft-spoken.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons that I engaged you and started talking to you about movie props and Halloween parties and stuff, because I could see that you were a nice dude even back then.
Yeah, I think one of those things is that I could just see like the happiness that came from you when you spoke about like scary movie props and especially even like around Halloween, your Halloween parties.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, one of these days, I hope that you'll make it to the Halloween party before I venture out of Florida, because they're getting bigger and they're getting more refined. This next one coming up, this coming October, is going to be the People of Walmart. And everybody that has talked about it or has been invited that I've talked to them about it, everybody is very excited about that theme. And I don't know why that is. It's just the fact that they can dress up or dress down, I guess, basically be white trash. Everybody's really excited about what they're going to do with their costume. But I've always had like this thing for Halloween. I think Christmas is kind of a given that everybody loves Christmas, the lights, the gifts. But you also see a really ugly side to people, whereas Halloween, you just basically dress up for one day or for the month of parties. But there's not a lot of stress with giving gifts and did I give a good enough gift or what do I get Aunt Mabel, whatever the case may be. It's a lot of stress around Christmas time for people, financial stress and then going out and seeing family and having to travel other states across town, maybe being with relatives you're not a big fan of. But Halloween, you don't have that. It's just very enjoyable.
I'd have to agree that Halloween is probably one of my favorite holidays, or especially that time of year, because you know the weather really starts to cool down and stuff like that.
Yeah, you get a chance to have a break from your job because you own your own business.
Yeah, around that time, you know, things start to slow down. So
you're like, thank God. What's your favorite Halloween costume that you've ever done?
I don't think I've ever dressed up like that. I think the times that I really dressed up was actually when I was a younger kid. Me and my parents, we moved to this country with basically nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. So we didn't really have money to like spend on like costumes and stuff like that. So I would use costumes that I had the previous years, you know, but two costumes that I had was one with like the, you know, Scream, the mask.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I dressed up couple years with that mask, and then another costume I think that was before that one was a Scorpion, you know, Mortal Kombat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's two of the costumes that I would wear.
Good to know.
Probably nothing to your standards, you know, because you've got some pretty crazy costumes, right?
You know, Alexis, it's not my place to judge people in their Halloween costumes. I think it's exciting to see people put effort and energy and to see people get excited about creating. I have a certain standard for myself.
Yeah.
And I've been to West Hollywood for the Halloween parade on Halloween, and I've seen what people in Hollywood produce. And so for me, that is very exciting, and I really like that challenge. And I don't sew my own costumes. I bring all my material to a couple of different seamstresses that put it together. So I have to give credit to other people, but I don't judge other people. I mean, I've done like where I just go to the Goodwill and I get medical scrubs, but then I put some type of like completely inappropriate twist on it because I want to make people laugh. But you know, there's been times where I haven't had the financial resources that I did in other years. And so, but it's not my place. I just love to see people, especially adults, get excited for a holiday that's typically associated with kids and trick-or-treating. Adults love it too. And to me, it's just really fun, really fun.
How long have you been dressing up? Ever since you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, and again, it goes back to when I was a kid. I absolutely loved collecting the candy and doing all the different costumes. I mean, as soon as I could walk, I enjoyed going out and trick-or-treating and you know, getting a pillowcase, going door to door. And it was really hard to give it up. I remember once it was like, I don't know, like 6th, 7th, 8th grade, around that time period where you're getting too old to do this. It was really hard for me to say that chapter in life is done. Now it's time for you to maybe start handing out the treats to the smaller children that come to the door. It's sad. But
yeah, which you still do, right? You give out candy on Halloween, right?
Oh, Reese's peanut butter cups or higher end. This past year, I gave out full-size candy bars because I love to see the kids. And again, the magic that they're dressed up as like Spider-Man or Batman or Cinderella or whatever they want to do. And they're excited about dressing up. And then you give them full-size candy bars. I remember those houses. In fact, I remember where I grew up. I remember this one particular house that gave out full-size candy bars. And as a kid, I was like, oh my God, that shit's so cool. Now, as an adult, I get to give out full-size candy bars. And you see the kid's face like, holy shit, that's a full-size Snickers. Yeah. And that's really cool.
Yeah, no, I think looking back on my childhood, I think those are the houses that you really remember the most, for sure.
Absolutely. Is there a favorite candy that you got as a kid?
I'd have to go basic and go with Hershey's.
Just Hershey's chocolate bar?
Or, you know, I'd probably switch it up a little bit and go with the almonds and the Hershey's. But I've always been a Hershey guy, you know?
Yeah, you know, I imagine you, because you're in great shape, that you're very conscious about what you're putting in your body. So it actually, and I know you like quesadillas, but you like a steak.
Yeah.
You told me that in our conversations.
Yeah. Quesadillas are good.
So just to say that you like Hershey's with almonds, I'm like, really? Wow. Okay. Good to know.
Got to get that protein in the almonds, you know?
Good call. Good call.
Yeah. Looking back on the costumes that you've done, which one would you have to say is your top three?
I probably am going to gauge it off of reactions that I get from people.
Okay.
The one that I wanted to do my whole entire life, ever since I saw Star Wars in 1977, is I was mesmerized by Darth Vader. And I remember as a kid, my good friend Jeff Torbett, his mom brought us to go see Darth Vader because he was appearing at JCPenney's. And I was so scared, Alexis. My heart was racing because I was in the room full of kids. But Darth Vader was there, and I was so worried that if I said or did something wrong and made him mad, he would kill me. Mm. And so I remember that experience, but I always wanted to be Darth Vader. And so this past Halloween, I did it. I got the Ruby's Deluxe costume and finally fulfilled that dream. So that was probably like one of the top bucket list items. It's an extremely uncomfortable costume. But I did it. That would be number one, I think. The other, of course, clowns don't scare me. They never have, but they really intimidate and scare other people. And I love dressing up as a clown and scaring people. Mm-hmm. And so I've done a couple of different versions of clowns, and I've done probably Ronald McDonald would have to be up there because I did Ronald McDonald 5 years ago, and the costume was brilliant. My seamstress in Utah, Sherilyn, sewed that. And it just turned out fantastic. And then Mark Reynolds, this photographer I use in Salt Lake City, he photographed it this past August. And it just really was perfect in every way. Third one, I really enjoyed doing the Tin Man because a group of us got together and we did the Wizard of Oz. And I was the Tin Man and I spent months on that costume. Again, another extremely uncomfortable costume, but I don't know if I'd ever redo that. That was terrible. We went to the club. We didn't win because it was a gay club, and of course, they're always going to vote for the guy that's half naked and flexing on the stage dressed as Rambo, which is bullshit because we put months into this. But anyways, I'm going to say those three for right now. If I think of another one. Oh, I take that back. The time that I did the Batman from the 1960s Batman television show, and the guy that I was dating was Robin. And so Batman and Robin from the 1960s television show, expensive costume. I think it was like $2,300 for both mine and his, but it was so identical to Adam West and Burt Ward. That was so cool. And then a week before the party that we were hosting, I caught him getting a blowjob in front of the house. So that sucked.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned this story in one of your previous podcast episodes, right? About when you were talking about your exes.
Yeah, it was miserable, and that whole experience left a bad taste in my mouth.
Well, that's crazy.
It sucked. I mean, it was months of work and effort. My costume came from three different countries.
Yeah. The Batman costume, right?
Yeah. The boots came from Brazil, the bodysuit from like Thailand, and the cowl came from Canada. So.
Oh, okay.
I sold them all right after because they were going to be associated with him and cheating. So, and I mean, another future partner couldn't wear that costume because it would be associated with an ex. So that would be bad. So.
Yeah, that would be bad. Is that, what, is that one of your more expensive costumes? Or because you go all out every year, I feel like. So
That, I think, to date is the most expensive costume. Yeah, Batman and Robin was like I said, $2,300. Darth Vader was like $1,000. Ronald McDonald was like $600, but she gave me a huge discount. I mean, usually it probably runs like $700. It's probably average $600-$700 because everything's custom made. I bring her the material, the patterns, and then we start like modifying with the pattern, the way it's drawn up. And then of course the boots and the accessories, the makeup, the wigs, the gloves, she has to modify this stuff. But in the end, I did the Child Catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I went to the grocery store in the costume, and I walked into the grocery store, and this girl walks by, and she goes, "You're the Child Catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang." And that is such a rewarding experience, Alexis, because it means that all those months of work have come together, and it works because I got identified right away who my character was. Very rewarding.
That sounds like one of a good thing to hear when people really – like your costume, you know?
Oh yeah, and they identify. It's like they know exactly who it is, because that movie's a pretty old movie, and so it's a little bit dated. This girl knew exactly who it was, and it was like the first time out in public, and it was really cool. The stars aligned perfectly.
Yeah, I didn't know what movie you were talking about. I think it's a little bit before my time, right? When did the movie come out?
I think it's the 60s, and it was Dick Van Dyke. Ian Fleming's The Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It was the car that gets modified and it can fly and it can turn into a boat. It's a children's movie, but it's a little strange.
Yeah.
But there's this really evil character, and the king does not allow children. And so this character, it was played by Robert Heltman, and he's a ballet dance background, but amazingly creepy guy. And he's got this long nose, and he can smell children. And so there's that element of, like, him being a creepy pedophile sort of thing. And so he goes through the town, and he knows there's children, and the toy maker was played by Benny Hill. He's hiding Dick Van Dyke's children in the toy shop in this secret compartment, and the child catcher doesn't find them, so he goes and he dresses up as a candy man and comes back and lures the children out and captures them in this horse-drawn carriage. It gave me nightmares as a kid. I watched the movie and it scared the shit out of me. And so as I became an adult, I'm like, I got to do that costume. And so I ordered this action figure of the Child Catcher that this company had made in the early 2000s. And so I brought it to the seamstress and I said, we need to make the coat. It needs to be this certain length. And she and I, we went through all the details of this thing, and she made it with a crooked top hat, the greasy long hair. It really came together nice, and it was really creepy. And people said, damn, man, you look really spooky. And then Mark Reynolds, the photographer, he did a photo shoot in Salt Lake City, and then did some great, amazing Photoshop with it. And people see that picture and they're like, man, that's a really cool costume. So,
well, hopefully I get to see those pictures one day. Cause you've shown me the Ronald McDonald one. I saw the Darth Vader.
Yeah.
So hopefully you get to show me the pictures after the podcast.
I will share. And I'll put pictures on the social media.
Yeah,
you know, for the podcast, so people can check them out. I think they might be on some of them, but I'll put all of them on the social media.
Cool. So since we're on the topic of movies, I know you really love scary movies. Other than scary movies, is there any other genre that you really like?
Documentaries.
Documentaries, yeah.
I love documentaries. I've been on a huge documentary kick. And when I was living in Salt Lake City, a lot of people don't know this, but the Sundance Film Festival that is up in Park City and it's in Salt Lake City. And if you're a resident of Utah, you get first dibs on tickets. You have to register on the Sundance website, but you get a time slot where you can buy tickets. At least that's the way it was when I lived there. I don't know if it's changed. So a lot of the films that appear at Sundance are documentaries. And I would go see documentaries all the time. And it really opened my eyes to certain things that documentaries cover all over the world. Some great, great films that I watched there.
Is it a certain topic, or it doesn't matter the kind of documentary that is being shown?
You know, there's some that appeal to me more so than others. Like if it's a documentary about travel, I'm probably not going to be watching it. But like maybe social issues. Of course, documentaries about particular celebrities. Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. That's a great documentary. The Queen of Versailles. That's a great documentary. Supersize Me about McDonald's and health. That was a great documentary by Martin Spurlock. Yeah, that, I mean, a lot, any of those sort of films. But there's ones that, like, if you're going to talk about, you know, lion tribes in Africa, I probably, it wouldn't engage me. I don't think that I would stay interested for 90 minutes.
I think those are one of the best ones, if I'm being honest, especially the ones with like that contain like, you know, those really bloody moments, you know.
There's a Facebook page you should probably follow if you do enjoy the animals and their whole process of, you know, eating other animals. And it's called Life or Death. And it's a Facebook page that has a lot of very graphic animal on animal interactions. And it's brutal. I mean, you know, of course, nature is brutal and it's very honest. And the way that lions hunt and devour their prey is it's not for the weak of heart, but it's part of our world. And so, but Life or Death on Facebook, for anybody listening to this, you know, be forewarned, there's a lot of really graphic stuff. I mean, you know, animals devouring other animals, and it's, they don't have a whole lot of table manners.
No, I bet they don't.
Yeah, but you might enjoy it, Alexis. You might, I don't, if you're into that aspect of nature.
Yeah, I'll check it out. What is your favorite movie? Like, what, maybe one that you grew up watching, and one of the recent ones?
Probably, well, my all-time favorite movie is Jaws, and it always will be.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it easily over 100 times, and I watch it once or twice a year. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not the only one, because Jaws has this huge, massive following, and I don't know if it was just, it hit at the right time. And it, again, it's another movie that scared me so bad as a child. My sister brought me to see it, and I remember going back to her apartment, and I was staying on her couch that night, and I could not fall asleep. I just kept seeing that guy's leg float to the bottom of the ocean, and I was absolutely terrified. And growing up, we went to the beach every year, and there was no way I was ever going in the water ever again because of that bad experience of Jaws. Yeah, that's definitely the go-to. I remember when I saw The Exorcist. I remember when I saw The Omen, The Amityville Horror, Friday the 13th. So as far as scary movies, if we go way back when I was a kid, I loved Pinocchio. I loved Jungle Book. I don't think I ever saw like Cinderella or Snow White. I don't think I would have been interested in it. Mm. I definitely, as a boy, I loved those movies with like antagonists in it. You know, you look at Pinocchio, there's a lot of really evil characters in that. Stromboli was his name. Mm-hmm. He was a great character. And then the two that lure Pinocchio and they sell him off, and he goes to the island with all the kids that turn into donkeys. Again, I loved Pinocchio. And then the Jungle Book with the snake. God, horrible stuff, but I was mesmerized by it.
Yeah.
And the classic Universal Monsters, and I don't know. It's just always that stuff that really got my heart racing as a child, which was the scary stuff. I was so into it. It's like an adrenaline rush. It's like a roller coaster if you find a scary movie as a child.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, horror films and movies, like they really played a huge part in your development as a person. Would you say so?
This almost feels like a loaded question. I'm afraid to answer. It's like, I knew that guy was fucked up. Now I know why. you know, I know that like a lot of people, and I run into people all the time, and they're like, oh, I don't know how you can watch that crap. And I remember in high school, I remember telling one of the football coaches that I was going to go see Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. like I was going to leave football practice and take the public bus to Tyson's Corner. And I remember the coaches just mocking the fuck out of me. They were really just dickheads.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, that whole machismo thing that you get in that time period with, like, you know, football, men are men. And when I had, like, opened up and made myself vulnerable as a kid and said, I'm going to go see this movie, I'm really excited. And they look at each other like, you know, what a dipshit. I think there was a time period maybe where I didn't tell too many people, like, my outspoken appreciation of horror movies, because I think it almost was associated with being a nerd or a dork or some type of derogatory term. Whereas now in 2023, it's gone more mainstream and you wear it kind of like a badge. I mean, it's cool to be a fan of horror movies and you have these horror conventions, but there was a time period where people were much more cruel and bullying was a big thing and it was more acceptable. I mean, you just kind of had to like stay in the closet per se about enjoying horror movies. Like, you know, what's wrong with you? Why do you like this movie so much? Why do you like this scary crap so much? And that was a lot of the people that, that I was around that were like my teachers and authority figures at that time period. So when I was a kid, I used to do haunted houses in my parents' basement. And then all the neighborhood kids would come to my house. And even into high school, I would do it. And it became so popular that like the teachers were coming to my parents' house to go through this haunted thing that I had made. And we were scaring the shit. And this is no joke, Alexis, we were scaring, because I went to Catholic school my whole life, my whole adolescence, and the priests were coming to this. And it was such a rush when you're like, you know, a junior or a senior in high school, and you see these authority figures, these priests, like grabbing each other. And this one particular priest, the following Monday after the haunted house, he showed me his bicep, and it's all bruised from this other priest grabbing him because he was so terrified. And to me, that was really, really kind of cool that we were able to scare adults like that, even though we were a bunch of high school kids.
So the high schoolers would be the ones scaring the teachers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, well, and it wasn't like, cause I went to private school and all my friends in my neighborhood, they were all in public school. So the only interaction that they knew these teachers was not because they went to that school. You know, they just were adults coming and lining up to go through this haunted attraction. And the teachers were very, very supportive. They're like, wow, you did a really good job. And I shouldn't say you, because it was my friends and I, you know, I was kind of the leader of the pack as far as like having the plan of the story as I guide you through this haunted attraction. And we tell the story of this family that's insane, that they're cannibals, they eat people. And then we bring you in and we tell you this story as you go from room to room. It was a lot of fun. It was just a different time period.
Yeah, I think that's something that the internet has done a really good job with, which is connect a lot of different people by a specific thing, you know, like scary movies or, I mean, you can pretty much find any niche group.
It's made like other countries and other groups that might be on the other side of the world, now you have instant access to these other groups, these other people, when you have similar interests. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So I've been to your house a couple of times, and your house is filled with scary movie props.
What was your first impression, Alexis?
I honestly thought it was pretty cool. You know, I didn't think it was like super weird or anything, but I did think I was like, wow, this house is pretty cool. It has tons of cool stuff with it. And some of it I did recognize, like a worm or something, I think from the movie Slither or something like that.
Yep.
So like seeing stuff like that, it's like, wow, like I remember that.
You had told me when the first time you came over to see the house, you had said that you were under the impression that I was going to show you everything was going to be boxed up in the garage. And then you come into the house and you see that there's like mannequins and displays, and it's from floor to wall. And then there's displays that sit away from the wall. There's eye bolts in the ceiling with different pieces hanging off the wall. you know, when you first walk in and then you're thinking like there's going to be a pile of boxes and he's going to open them up and show me different props, but then you saw it firsthand.
I think my favorite things that I looked at, I don't know if they're called pieces or props, but it would have to be the Jeepers Creepers characters with their clothes. I think that's one of my favorite things that I saw in your house.
And you've seen those movies.
Yeah, that's actually one of the movies I grew up watching. And I still, you know, sometimes I rewatch it again.
I don't know if you know, there's now 4 of those movies.
Like throughout the past years, I've heard that there was going to be a new Jeepers Creepers movie, but I haven't gotten the time to watch it. I think I've only seen the first 2 or 3, but other than that, that's all I've watched. Yeah.
And the first one was filmed not too far from us.
Yeah. Was it in Ocala?
Yep.
Yeah, that's cool.
In fact, there is a convention over in Ocala. The last couple of times they've had this convention, they've actually had the Creepers truck, the prop truck used in the movie was there.
The actual truck?
Yep.
Pretty cool.
It was pretty cool, but it was, I think they wanted like $20 to take a picture of it. You could not even take a picture unless you paid them.
Out of everything you collected, the props, the clothes, what would you have to say is like, you know, your favorite piece?
It's funny because people, when they talk about the stuff that I've collected, they always bring up like the clothes and the props. And, you know, some prop collectors are like, I don't know why you got all these clothes. What's the point? The thing with the clothes is that they break down not nearly as fast as props that are made out of like foam latex and such. And so the clothing is going to last a lot longer. Now, the stuff that they use now to make the props doesn't break down as quickly, and so they'll be around for a long time. But like your 80s horror movies, a lot of that stuff's made of foam latex. And I've got that one head from Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, that head of Carol Ann. Mm-hmm. And Tom Spina Designs has already fixed it once. They had to rebuild her nose and her lips. That was a lot of money. It was like, I think, $1,800 to have them redo that to fix her. But since I had it done, which has been 5 years, her neck is cracking. I mean, eventually it's going to be constant upkeep to maintain that. But as far as like my favorite thing, I've always said it's that head from Hannibal, of Ray Liotta's mechanical head. But I also got the dress of Kathy Bates from the movie Misery when she's having dinner with James Caan and he's trying to drug her and she tips over the wine glass. That dress is pretty cool. And then I've got one of the outfits worn in Mommy Dearest by Faye Dunaway. And that's a pretty cool piece because that's just a great over-the-top movie. But that's not even a horror movie. I don't know. I think that like the one that causes me the most grief was this husband-wife team. They had come out to the house and did a segment during COVID. And I had referred to the axe used by Ice Cube in Anaconda to kill the snake that's in my bedroom. And I had said Ice Tea rather than Ice Cube. And so people on the internet just absolutely, basically I was a piece of meat and they were piranha. Yeah. Like if you look at the comments, it's like, God, you're a fucking idiot. You don't even know the difference between Ice Cube and Ice-T. I mean, both of these guys are incredible artists. They're both amazing musicians. They're both very accomplished actors. I don't think it's an insult. I misspoke. I referred to Ice Cube as Ice-T. I apologize to all the Ice Cube followers and lovers. I never meant any disrespect.
Yeah, I think people on the internet can be a little bit harsh sometimes.
Well, they just love to correct you. They just love to say, oh, you're wrong. You're wrong. But, you know, trolls are, they're here to stay, I think. So,
Yeah. The mask from Hannibal or the head, right? And the dress from
Misery, yes. Those are the first two, of course, that, you know, probably have the most attention from people when they come to the house. But, you know, it's interesting because it's like people come to the house and if there's some movie that they connect with or they remember, that's going to be the piece that they're going to like. And it might be something that's small, like the worm from Slither that you referred to.
Yeah.
You know, that might be a piece that's going to stick in your head because you immediately identify that that prop.
Yeah. But
for other people that come in, maybe a different generation, it might be an age thing, and they see a movie that scared them, it might be Drag Me to Hell. So the Miss Ganoush puppet is the one that they're like, oh my God, that's so cool. Mm. So, you know, for me, Hannibal, that head was, and I knew it was just such an iconic scene. A lot of people remember it. And so it was really cool to acquire that. And then Misery, I remember like the first time I saw it. And it's like one of my mom's favorite movies. So definitely I connect to that. Sure.
Is there one, a piece that people typically go to like first, like the one that like it stands out the most to the majority of people that go to your house?
Alexis, I think that the piece that most people go to is not even a screen use prop, but people love to take a selfie with Freddy Krueger, and it's not a screen use prop. It's just a replica, and he's standing in the corner of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But people love to take a selfie with Freddy because his hand is out with the claw. Everybody seems to congregate towards him to get a picture with him. Even when I had him in Utah, the Scareware Productions made that head and I attached it to a mannequin and then got the sweater and stuff. So people really love that. As far as like the, I guess for people that are like prop collectors and collect wardrobe from films, they each have their own individual piece. My friend Kevin, who came on the podcast and we talked about horror conventions, he loves the minor costume that's in my bedroom. That's the piece that like disturbs people the most. Because they're like, how do you have this standing next to your bed? Does that not give you nightmares? Like, is there something wrong with you? That and the casket that I've got in the bar.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen the piece you're talking about in your bedroom.
In the minor, you didn't see he's holding the pickaxe?
You know, my memory's a little bit bad sometimes, so I don't think so.
The next time you come over, you got to take a selfie. And you gotta get next to the miner so you can show your friends, and then your friends can say, what? You actually go to this fucker's house? Is he on the FBI's most wanted list? What the fuck?
Yeah. when did you start collecting props?
That is a good question. I think it was 2000 or 2001. And I had seen an outfit worn by Kane Hodder in Jason X. There was a company in LA that was listing stuff. It was called Star Wars Collectibles. They had his two-piece outfit, one of like 40 or 50 gray two-piece outfits that Jason wears in Jason X, and it's riddled with bullet holes. I remember it was selling for $1,200, which was a lot of money back then. By today's standards, that is nothing. And so I had bought that, and then the same company listed his fingerless gloves and then the neck shackle and handcuffs. So I had bought all three pieces and had the majority of his outfit. I never got the straight jacket. And again, money, was a lot tighter back in 2000, but I wish I had splurged, but I ended up selling that costume anyways to a guy named Mario Kerner, who is in Germany. And he ended up becoming like the most prominent Friday the 13th collector in this whole hobby. And he has more of the masks and the outfits and memorabilia, promotional material of Friday the 13th than I think anybody in the world. But he has started to sell off the collection through the prop store. And I know he's sold, I think, two of the hockey masks now, and each one sold for like
$95,000. $95,000.
Each, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, pretty good price.
He's doing well. He's doing very well. Yeah. I had messaged him last week because he had put out a book a few years ago about his collection, documenting all these artifacts, all these props and wardrobe from the original movies, and put out this really nice book. And I wanted to get a copy of it, so I bought one. And it came to the United States from Germany, and it got hung up in the postal service and got shipped back to Germany. So he's sending me another one. I get to see the several items that I sold him. I get to see an update as to where they went, and I don't know who's going to end up with him since he's selling everything now. But
well, yeah, you have a pretty awesome collection for, you know, doing it for 20 years.
You know, I went through a period where I sold everything, Alexis, because I wanted to make my movies myself. I said to myself, why are you collecting stuff that belongs to other writers and directors and actors, why don't you create your own material? And that's where I started getting into video production myself. And I sold all my original collection in like 2006, 2007, and which was a big mistake, started making videos. So,
yeah, which is one of your hobbies that I wanted to get into. Yeah, so one of the films that you produced, you've actually got me to watch, which is China Buffet. Uh-huh. So, yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Anybody that's thinking about making a movie, I really want you to sit down and have a conversation with me before you do it, because it is so much work. You have no idea how much work is involved in producing your own independently made movie. And you hear about independent film, and it's frustrating for me, and I've talked about this over and over again, because like going to Sundance and these film festivals were originally catered to independent filmmakers like to have a voice. So you go out, you raise money, you make a movie, and if it's really good, you know, let's shop it around to different studios, and then they'll sell it, and you have these film festivals that would do that and give independent filmmakers a voice. That's not so much the case with Sundance anymore. And I talked about in another podcast, and I think it was the one with Lance, when we talked about the China Buffet, but we had gone to a screening of this movie, and William H. Macy gets up in front of the crowd, and he's talking about making this movie and how difficult it was because they only had $20 million.
Only $20
million. And I'm like, are you fucking high? And the China Buffet ended up costing me like 15 grand. But mm-hmm. I was funding it. And Alexis, I was going to these high interest rate loan places because we had to film a scene and it was going to cost me 500 bucks. And my payday wasn't for another week and a half. I'd have to do a short-term loan at like some outrageous percentage amount to have the money to buy the props, wardrobe, location, gas, food, whatever, in order to get the thing done.
How long did it take you to get that film together?
There was so many people involved, so many awesome guys and girls. And you know, I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole and start naming people because I don't want to offend anybody I don't name.
Yeah.
A lot of people were involved, and so many people gave their heart and soul to the China Buffet. And it took 3 years. And initially the script was written and there were supposed to be three main characters. And one of the main characters like dropped out like a week before because he is Mormon or was Mormon. He was gay, but he was married to a woman to satisfy the whole religion bullshit. So he decided that he could not be in this movie because it was a gay themed movie. So he had told us like a week before we're going to film, hey, I can't do this movie. I can't stand before God and do this. And so we had to rewrite it really fast and write his character out. Lance absorbed two characters is basically the way it ended up getting written. But then we had to scramble because like we're ready to film. Now we got to rewrite the script because of that guy.
Mm. And Lance was your best friend, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you hear the episode where he came on the podcast?
I don't think so. Not yet.
Okay. He comes on and he talks about it. And he's got some great stories about another individual that ended up being in the movie. I don't want to spoil it too much, but Alexis, it's a crazy situation.
Yeah.
You talk about movies like The Exorcist and all the people that died during the making of The Exorcist. And it seems to happen every few years, like The Poltergeist, The Exorcist, The Omen. Was there a curse with this movie? You know, because these movies are about like satanic themes. You look at The China Buffet and all the people that were involved with that movie, a lot of people have passed away.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Aunt Jolene with the dog and the lick in the face of Aunt Jolene, she passed away years ago. And Bradley, who was the therapist, he passed away. And Jericho, he passed away. There's a lot of people that were in that movie, but that's just time. I mean, we all live out our life and we all die at different time periods. And so it's crazy, though.
What was one of the more challenging obstacles for the producing that film, would you say? Was it the money?
you know, the money really wasn't bad because it was spread out over 3 years. So timing and like certain scenes, we had to like wait. You know, I talked about like how we got the auditorium, and that was kind of like a backhanded deal. And another podcast, we talk about filming inside the prison, the opening credits, and having to carry the insurance policy. The administration from the prison tried to get out of doing it, and I had to go up the chain of command, and there was that whole fiasco. I played the game, and I had to get this insurance policy for $800 for 4 hours worth of filming. Is there a particular scene? One scene that we talked about, or we did not talk about, we regretted not talking about it on the episode with Lance, is there's a scene where Lance is doing cosmetics. His character is a mortician, and he's doing cosmetics on this woman that was decapitated in the car accident. Do you remember that scene?
I don't think I do.
We filmed inside an actual funeral home. And so the day before we filmed, I went in to see where the embalming room is, and they were so nice to cater to us and allow us to film in there. And so I go in, and there's this one cold room where they keep all the bodies that they have to get prepped for funerals all over the county, Davis and Weber County. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know what to expect. I just wanted to see the lighting to see if I had to bring in lights or if it was going to be bright enough that I wouldn't have to do that. So I go in, and I go into this room, and there's like, God, there's like 10 to 15 dead bodies.
All out? So you could see all the bodies?
Oh, yeah, they're all on tables, yeah. Oh. And most of them are people that are old that died like at a nursing home. Yeah. And so like they're wrapped up in their sheets from the bed. But they're all contorted, however they died when they were sleeping. Mm-hmm. And Alexis, I'd never seen anything like that in my life.
How did that change you? You think it played a part, like, you know, a little bit of trauma there?
No, I don't think that there's trauma. I just, for these people, it's like, this is, you know, this is a day in the life. Like, this is our job. We come in and we embalm them and we loosen up the muscles and we can pose them. And then we have to do cosmetics. If there's reconstruction on their face or their head, we want to make them presentable for the family if we can do it. Mm-hmm. And so for them, they're around it all the time. They go pick up these bodies from, like, you know, the hospital, the medical examiner, the nursing home, and bring them there. And this one particular building where we were filming, basically that was their main funeral home. All the other funeral homes throughout the two counties, those are just chapels. So this is the one place where they do all the cosmetics, they wash the body, they prep it. It's all done in this one location. So all the bodies, when they first come in, they go there, they get prepped, placed in a casket once they look beautiful, and they take the casket to the funeral home for the service. Mm. So that's why there's so many bodies in this one place, because that handles, they might have like 6, 7, 8, 10, I don't even know, chapels, you know, to cater to residents for wherever that chapel's located. And it was a family-owned funeral home. Walking in and just seeing that, it was very real. It was like a documentary. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, the Great and Powerful Oz, and the curtain gets pulled out and you see how shit really works. And that's why I love documentaries. And so I walked in and I saw this, and it did take my breath away.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's a lot of dead people right there. And then the next room over is where they have the tables where they actually put in the formaldehyde and drain the blood. That's the room where we filmed. And I brought my own medical table with like the fake body and the fake head that Cesar had done the casting of Michelle. And when he did the casting of her face, you know, she had to grimace like her head hit the floor because of the gag of that scene. Mm-hmm. And so everything was ready. We had like 2 or 4 hours to film that scene. And so it was like rush, 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 rush. They have catered to us. We had to pay nothing to film there. And so it was amazing. They were great, wonderful. I'm very thankful to them, you know, and they said, look, we don't mind helping you out, but just please don't mention us in the credits, because we don't want people to think we would ever allow a decapitated family member their head to roll off the table and bounce on the ground.
Yeah.
Which is what happened in the scene. So really great people though.
Yeah, you've been in a lot of like commercials and stuff like that. So do you think it's better to be like a director or an actor? Which one, what role did you like playing more?
Here's the thing is I had this interest in getting into film production, you know, ever since I was a kid. I got my first camera in sixth grade. 8mm real film. I begged my parents. And they're like, you're going to play with it for like a month and then it's going to go in the closet and you're never going to use it again. And they couldn't have been more wrong, because even now, as we're talking, you know this, and I don't know how many other people know this, I have just invested in all brand new equipment, and we start filming new projects next Saturday. Definitely the spark hit when I was like in sixth grade, when I saw Best Company catalog that a Canon camera and a Canon projector, you could make movies. And I was in, I was like, I got to do this. And then it advanced to video. My brother was an extra in the movie, The Untouchables. And that definitely kind of was inspiring too, because even though he's just an extra, he's in the scene where the little girl has the briefcase and she comes running out of the bar. Sir, you forgot your briefcase, and the briefcase blows up. Prior to that bar scene, you see a guy on a bicycle riding along the sidewalk, and that was my brother. And I was like, that's really cool. So when I had gone out to Salt Lake City, or when I moved out to Utah and I was working at the prison, and it's like, okay, I've got a job, I've got benefits, I've got a career, I want to start pursuing other interests that I, you know, I want to do. And one of those was I wanted to get involved with the film industry, which at that time period was very active in Utah. A lot of Disney films, a lot of commercials. So I started doing extra work so I could start to put together a resume. After I had done extra work and got bored with that, basically you're just walking across the scene. You start on mark A, you go to point B, and then it's back to one. And you do it over and over and over, and then you change your clothes, and they use you in a different scene, and they use you for 12 hours. And back then it was $72.50 for 12 hours, $72.50. And I dragged Tony, my friend Tony at the prison, I dragged him into it. And then it advanced to wanting to do like speaking lines, speaking roles. My first audition was The Crow, Salvation, one of the sequels to The Crow. And I think Eddie Furlong is in that one. But I went in to go audition for this part, and it was for a police sergeant. And I went in, and I was so fucking nervous. So nervous. And I went in, and I did these lines, and the casting director, who I got to know a lot better later, but she's sitting there, and Alexis, she rolled her eyes at me.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, it's like, well, that couldn't have gotten worse, I guess. I guess if I insulted the casting director, but it was not a good audition at all. And I remember walking out of there, and I was so frustrated and so flustered and whatever. I kept at it. It took like a year and a half, 2 years of constantly going to auditions that I landed my first part, and that was a commercial for the Mormon Church that is on the Gay Florida Man podcast YouTube page. So yeah, I kept doing it and then got little parts here and there. To answer your question, is it more satisfying to do acting or is it more satisfying to do directing? I never felt satisfaction in acting. It's definitely a lot more fun to write your own material and then to act it out than it is to go in and do like a day player, like a one or two lines, and have a director tell you, emphasize this word, pause at this word, remember to do this or do that. And you're a day player, you're in a regional area, because I was in Utah. Of course, if you really want to pursue it big time, you get to a certain point where you have to move to Los Angeles or California. But it was more satisfying to write and direct, for sure. Way more satisfying.
Yeah, and you've directed, I think, two films, right? One for the recruiting thing at the Utah prison, right?
Yeah, I did the recruitment video for the Utah State Prison back in the day. And the whole controversy with that was all captured on the podcast episode talking about different administrations. But you're working for a client, you know, basically you're putting together material that they want, And even though your vision might be different from theirs, they're the ones paying you, so you got to do whatever they want. I remember when I interviewed Carl Beekler, who directed Friday the 13th Part 7, and he was talking about the frustration with dealing with a producer from Paramount Studios who didn't really care about the reveal of Jason in that movie. He went into great detail about his frustration. He's the director, but essentially the producer has the control and call the shots. So when you're working for somebody else, yeah, you're the director, but it's essentially what the producer wants, whoever is the money person. I'm happy with the way that the video turned out. And again, it was a group project. I didn't write the dialogue. That was done by Corey Greer and the spokesperson for the department at that time. But I did do all the filming and all the shots and stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And that's actually your career as a corrections officer. What made you go into that line of work?
Oh, stupidity.
Yeah. No. Was it because they give good benefits, right?
Good question. I look back and I think I really wanted to do film.
Yeah.
But I'm also very much like my father. I need stability.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in the entertainment industry, it's feast or famine. And a lady that did wardrobe told me one time, the best thing about being in the business is telling people you're in it. I realize that there's some unpredictable things about being in the film industry, because you might work for a commercial for a week or 2 weeks or maybe even a day, but then you're back in the unemployment line because you're constantly looking for work. You got to be ahead of the next guy. It's all about networking and knowing other people. I needed stability. I needed to know that I have health insurance, that I've got a regular income, a salary. Even though I always wanted to do film, I wanted stability. And so that's why I went the whole route of like trying to help people and becoming a police officer. And so I was a police officer for a very short time. That did not work at all. I probably shouldn't have picked a small town or small city in Utah and not being Mormon and moving 2,000 miles away. That was me being very naive. And so I went out there and I was a police officer initially in Utah. That's why I moved to Utah. And then I was forced out. It was one of those situations where they washed me out of the on-the-job training. They basically gave me a choice saying, look, we have to make some decisions here. You can quit or we'll have to make some decisions. And I said, well, I quit. But, you know, 2 weeks prior to that, they had said, we're not going to get rid of you no matter what. We've invested a lot of money in you. But then they changed their mind. So, but I was also 25 years old at the time. Very difficult time period. But that's where I ended up going to corrections, because a friend of mine who also worked for this department had said, my husband works at the prison and he really wants to talk to you. And I talked to him. He's like, you know, you're not going to get this political bullshit you're dealing with in this city. Go and work at the prison. It's huge. It's massive. And you know, you can have a career. And so that's what I did. I never envisioned myself working at a prison in a million years. So,
it was just like the stability that really attracted you.
You know, it was the stability. Well, I mean, at that point, Alexis, I had moved from Virginia, Northern Virginia, out to Utah to become a police officer, thinking that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then I get out there and then I'm unemployed. 6 months after moving out there, I'm unemployed. Then I end up working like in a warehouse for a furniture store, loading up trucks while I apply for the prison. It was survival, because in that time period, now I've accumulated all this debt. Mm-hmm. And then I'm making, you know, like, I don't know, $10 or $12 an hour. No, I think I was making $12 an hour at the furniture store. And so I wanted to get back into some type of government work and have insurance and a retirement. So that's when I went and worked at the prison. And back then, it was very easy to get hired by the Department of Corrections. Not as easy as it is now, because they can't find anybody but that wants to work those jobs. Initially, I wanted to become a Virginia State Trooper. That was my dream. I always looked up to those guys, and I saw them as just absolutely perfect. Again, I was very naive. You know, glad that that didn't happen. And glad I didn't end up becoming a police officer. I think that would have been a huge mistake, because I think that they would have taken a huge toll on my body with the stress and the way that police officers typically don't eat very well. They're forced into a situation where it's hard to take care of yourself in law enforcement. You're in and out of that car. You're wearing all that equipment. It's very high stress. It's a lot of stress, no stress. A lot of stress, no stress. And those guys have a terrible job, but it takes its toll, and then their life expectancy is greatly reduced.
So you would say being like a police officer compared to a corrections officer is a lot harder?
I think corrections officer, you get a lot more chance to see what's current on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. Well, I think that there's more downtime. I mean, I think that both jobs are very difficult. They both are very, very political. You might have a chief that you think is great and fantastic and supports you, but in 5 or 6 years, that guy might retire. You might get a new chief who's a total cunt. That takes its toll on you. All the personalities that you have to work with, some of them are great, some of them are not so great. And a lot of the job is not so much the criminals or the inmates, if you're working in a correctional facility. A lot of it is just the politics. And, you know, you signed on and you had all these great benefit package, per se, and a great retirement. And then government and administrators chisel away at it, and they start putting in new policies, and it makes the job miserable. So it's a lot of times it's not even the criminals that you have to worry about. It's these people that you entrust when you started working there, or their replacements. It's a very tough game. I know right now they're trying to do away with career service protections in Utah, and it didn't pass this past legislative session from what I'm reading online, but you basically would be an at-will employee where you don't have a career service review in certain situations to protect your employment, which is dangerous. And they're going the wrong way if they're trying to recruit and retain good employees in the state. But I guess time will tell.
I remember, because I've also had like a customer that was a corrections officer in California.
Uh-huh.
And he said that now times are a lot worse compared to times before then. Would you agree with that? You know, maybe the system has changed, but it's changed for the worse.
Well, I guess it's in regards to, like, do you know what he was talking about? Is he talking about benefits and requirements of the job?
I think he was talking more about, like, you know, how like gangs have like it became more powerful and stuff like that. I had this conversation a while ago, so I don't exactly remember what he was referring to when he said that, but I think just like the overall job, you know.
Again, I only can speak on behalf of corrections, because I worked the streets a long time ago for a very short period of time. It's definitely changed. And there was a period where it was very hard to become a police officer. I mean, there were so many people applying. When I had applied for the Virginia State Police back in like 95, 96, they had 4,000 people applying for 80 jobs. Mm-hmm. Now they can't get enough people to apply. But as far as the job has definitely changed, I think it's a lot harder to be a police officer now. As far as in corrections, I think the job is pretty much the same, but they have gone the way of this thing called direct supervision, where they want you as a correction officer more in contact with the inmates. So you're in the section more. You're at a desk in the section. Whereas before, the section door is shut and you're outside and you do section checks, where you go in and you patrol the section.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you might have to do that every 30 minutes or every 60 minutes. But now they want you sitting in the section, so you're face-to-face with the inmates, you know, in general population all day long. Another policy that I've talked about in the past, too, that they've changed. It used to be, I only can stay in Utah because that's where I worked. But you could do 5, 10, 15 years in a housing unit where you work with the same people for the most part, all the time. You know the job, you know your inmates, and you become comfortable with your building. You can do a whole career almost there. And it's really not that stressful if you're in like a minimum housing unit, you know, minimum security housing unit. But a new administrator comes in and says, nope, you're going to do 3 years max in a particular housing unit, you have to find a new home. So every 3 years, you have to go and transfer to a different part of the prison and work with a whole new staff, deal with a whole different set of inmates that you don't know, may or may not know. A lot of people that were working at the prison for 15, 20, 25 years said, I'm not going to do that. I mean, if you don't touch me, I'll do another 5-10 years. Nope, you got to move every 3 years. So a lot of those people retire. So you lost all that experience. They all retired. They left.
And do you think there was a reason for doing that? Maybe to have like all the corrections officers be well-rounded to kind of like fit anywhere?
There's this concern about becoming complacent. Mm-hmm. You become too comfortable in the position. You become less aware of what's happening. And you're too comfortable in that position. You've been in this unit for 10 years and you're not as sharp as you are, as you were, you know? And so complacency was their concern. And that's the number one thing. At least the higher ups that I talk to, they always bring up the word complacency. That was their concern. But I look at the people that I worked with or were there before me, and I think about how they managed. And the last word I would ever use is complacency. They still had certain inmates that they could go to talk to what's going on in the unit, or they would get information about what's happening in the block. So they were still on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, every situation, I guess, is different. I mean, there are certain staff that are going to fall into that complacency, and then that's not safe. So I understand the complacency argument, but it's not always true. So,
yeah. What do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about that line of work?
Well, I think that there's that general idea that corrections officers are knuckle-dragging, thick-skulled Neanderthal idiots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, of course, is not true. Some of the most brilliant people, funniest people I've ever worked with, were corrections officer. And I think of my friend Tony, who was absolutely brilliant, Alexis. His sense of humor was so sharp. And I got him into the whole film thing because I'm like, you are such a waste because you're so talented. You're so fucking funny. And I hate the fact that you're working in a prison. But I also think that Tony was also ahead of the curve and he'll never get the credit that he deserves, because was the job challenging to him? No. Could he have done something much more magnificent? Yes. Could he have become head of HR, or could he have, you know, gone into the state police and worked his way up through the ranks? Absolutely could have. He could have been brilliant. But the job of working in a prison was a means to an end for Tony. It didn't offer a lot of challenge, but the most important thing to him was his relationship with his wife and mm-hmm. spending time with her. He had no interest in the fanfare of working your way up through the ranks and becoming like a lieutenant, captain, or a greater job. He knew that this job took care of all the bills and he was comfortable. I mean, he could travel if he wanted to. He'd go out to dinner if he wanted to. He was an amazing chef. He didn't need any of that. He didn't need any type of, you know, recognition. So he did this job that was probably below him because he didn't need any of that. And the job for him was fairly low stress. He knew how to handle situations. He knew how to talk to people. He was an excellent communicator. He did it. He was just a brilliant guy. I think he's smart in the fact, why would I want to go do that and go try to work my way up through the ranks and start playing this political game that's going to cause me stress?
So the main reason why he did it was just to have some free time with his wife?
His priority was his wife. His absolute number one priority. His life was about his wife, Penny. He loved his wife more than anything. And so, you know, he did this job and he needed to have a job that had health insurance and a retirement, but it's all just a means to an end. He doesn't care about the fanfare of being a corrections officer. He doesn't need that big plaque with a badge and all these awards and everything. He went in and the job offered him no challenge, but because for him, his priority was his wife, his love of his life.
Did his wife also work in that same like career?
She worked for the state as well, but she worked for the Liquor Commission. Mm. So she got a retirement as well. And then they both retired together.
Interesting.
Yeah. So they had a double retirement, and then, you know, they'd saved up all their sick leave for all the years. So they got like a whole bunch of health insurance until they reach that age for like Medicare, Medicaid, whatever that kicks in at a certain age point. You know, they traveled when they wanted to. They, you know, gamble. They would go to Vegas all the time. They had timeshare in Vegas. So, you know, being a correctional officer was no challenge for Tony, but he didn't want challenge. He had no interest. It wasn't a passion for him. It was a means to an end. So he could retire and have something, you know, his nest egg when he left. I dragged him into doing the videos, and we even got him into drag and the Dr. Will thing. God, he loved writing the sketches because, again, the guy was so brilliant with humor. He was really intelligent. And I remember one time, the only time that he was ever arrogant to me, because we were talking about being children and like flashlight tag and playing with other kids. And he said that he used to go to the library all summer long as a kid, and he would just read books. And we were talking about The Wizard of Oz, and he was telling me about how there's so many books to the Oz series. And he's like, I bet you didn't know that. There are X amount of different Oz stories, and I've read them all. And when he's talking to me, he's very condescending. And he's like, I bet you didn't even know that, did you? And I looked at him and I said, no, I didn't know that because I had friends and I wasn't a fucking nerd. Because, and I don't think he wasn't even meaning to be like arrogant and condescending, but he came across like that. And I don't know if he thought I was going to sit there and take it, but I'm like, fuck you, man. Like, I had a great time, you know, playing all these neighborhood games with my friends, kick the can, flashlight tag, all these other things, while you were at the library reading about the Oz books, whatever. So it was, he was a best friend for sure. He was an amazing, such a brilliant guy with his use of comedy. And he was great to work with, too.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about certain situations and experiences that were kind of dangerous on your podcast already. What would you say is the most dangerous one that you've been through?
The most dangerous situation, I don't know that I've ever talked about this particular. I mean, most of the situations, if they were dangerous, I was around other people or in very close proximity to other officers. There's this one situation, and this guy was, it was on dog block, and he was a very muscular Latino guy. He was from Texas, and I forgot his name, but I remember it was early on in me working dog block, and I was doing a tier check, and I was on the bottom tier, and I went out into the rec yard, and there was a staircase that you could go up the staircase and then back through the tier on the second or third floor. And I can't remember the conversation I had with this guy, but I remember he put his arm out. He blocked me from going up the staircase. And I can't remember exactly what I said, but it was like I told him to move his arm and he wouldn't do it. And it was the first time that I'd seen somebody have the fucking audacity to seriously, right there to my face, say, you know, basically without saying anything, but giving me the implication of no, the nonverbal communication of no. And I was so close to escalating that situation by getting on the radio saying, I need assistance. I think that he would have pulled his arm back right away. And I don't know why he did pull his arm out of the way shortly after that. But as I look back, and I still remember it so vividly, Alexis, but it was one of those situations where things could have really gotten out of hand. I think that he was getting out of prison within the next like 36 months. And if it had escalated, he would have probably been in prison for a lot longer. So he knew that. It's one of those situations where as I think back, I'm like, I should have just gotten on the radio and said, I need assistance on the yard of dog block. And there would have been like 15 people come running.
Yeah.
He would have been sent to Max. God, I can't remember that guy's name, but he was a dangerous son of a bitch, really.
You don't think it would have escalated the situation?
Oh, I mean, but if it escalated, I would have already had help coming. I mean, it would have been like, you know, 45 seconds, minute and a half before people would have been in the yard with me.
Yeah, but I mean, like you said, like every second counts.
Yeah, but if we had gone hands-on and if he'd been bright enough, to say, okay, get his fucking radio away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Then it could have been 5, 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So that could have been really ugly, and I really could have gotten fucked up. So
yeah, but every day wouldn't be like that, though, right? It'd be
no, that was a very rare occasion. The guy didn't like me, and I didn't like him. That had been established. And he had this little shamrock medallion on his neck, which they can't have. I forgot again how this broke down, but he had it, and I'm like, where did you get that? And he's like, oh, it's been approved by the lieutenant. And I said, well, if I talk to the lieutenant, he says no. And of course, I'm going to always follow through and say, hey, did you approve this guy to have this thing? Like, it's not a religious related item, so he can't have it. But, you know, I went down and I went through his cell and I took everything, and he had a lot of shit he couldn't have. So at that point, it's on. There was already a history with us.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like me. I didn't like him. And one time I told him, you need to do this and this, and you have like until a certain time to do it. And he didn't do it. So I moved him from the second tier to the bottom tier, and I put him on a top bunk. And that's to send a message. If you fuck with me, then I will handle you.
And is there a meaning to having a top bunk?
If you're an inmate inside a prison, at least in Utah, again, I only can speak on behalf of Utah. Basically, the bottom bunk is for your older or your heavies. Why would they climb up on the top bunk? That's for somebody that's isn't established. We'll say that. You're older, more well-known. Again, I use the word heavies because that was a term that was used in Utah. Is like the heavies would be like, hey, new guy, you're on the top bunk. I got the bottom bunk. That's just going to be known. If you go into a cell and you're housed with a guy that's been there that knows everybody in the block, you're going to be on the top bunk. And so I purposely put him on a top bunk to send that message. Don't fuck with me. I'm the sergeant. If we're going to go the rounds on this, I'm going to win. I'm always going to win.
How early was that into your career?
2008 or 9. 10 years in. Halfway through my career. Yeah. The other situation, the other oh shit that I can think of is there was this inmate named Danny, and he was in a medical cell in Olympus, and he was a much older guy, mentally ill guy, and he was I forgot why he was down there in that med cell, but again, you just never know when a situation's going to get out of hand, especially with the mentally ill. I had to go into his cell. He's housed alone in this medical cell, and it's way far away from the sections. This guy had to wear a diaper, and he would always urinate. We'd have to throw away his mattress because it would be saturated with urine. A single bunk mattress is pretty big, but when it's filled with moisture, urine, that son of a bitch is heavy. So
yeah,
take 3 or 4 inmates to haul that thing out to the dumpster to throw it away. Well, I had to go in there. And again, this guy is not a fighter. He's not a Kappa, like an aggressive inmate. And I had to go into the cell for something. And I went to go leave. He grabbed my arm. He didn't want me to leave. And when he actually touched me, it really shocked me, Alexis. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, man? And I go to pull away, and this son of a bitch is strong. And I had to push him back, and my pushing him didn't really have a whole lot of effect on him. Like I moved him back maybe a few inches, but I got out of there and slammed that door, and it was a keyed lock. It wasn't an electronic lock of any kind. But I was like, God damn, man, that could have really gotten bad fast.
You're a pretty big guy. So, I mean, how much bigger was he, or was he just like crazy strong for no reason?
Well, again, I'm not going to use the derogatory term, but there's an old term that's been around. Don't underestimate those people just because they're older or they appear slower, they're mentally ill, and you assume that they're not strong. Don't underestimate anybody inside a correctional facility. Danny was, man, he had a pretty good grip. But just the fact that he touched me, I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
When somebody touches you, it's like somebody out of the blue grabs your arm. And I had to do it when I did loss prevention, when I used to catch shoplifters. I'd have to run up on somebody that's got stolen goods and grab their arm. And at that point, you know, it's like they're either going to comply and let you put handcuffs on them, or they're going to try to punch you right in the face, or they're going to just try to break free and run. Mm-hmm. But when somebody touches you, instantly you get this adrenaline.
Yeah. But, trying to protect yourself, basically.
Yeah. It's like, wait a minute. What are you doing?
What are the most important qualities that a corrections officer should have?
Oh, patience.
Patience.
You got to be patient. The game has changed so much. I've already been gone 6 years. You know, I had very, very, very few physical interactions with people. And a lot of it is just taking the time to listen to people goes a long way. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a time where you have to be firm. You've got to assert yourself. If not, the inmates are going to see that, you know, you're not a strong personality. And so they're going to take advantage of you. They're going to try to work you. So, you know, they always said firm but fair, firm but fair, firm but fair. When you work in a correctional facility, take the time to listen to people. Not saying that you shouldn't have situational awareness. If you're in a section and you're talking to a guy, make sure you're aware of what the other inmates are doing. Because they had that one situation in the Oakers where it was right at shift change and they distract the guy in the control room. And in this other section, they're stomping this guy's head. They ended up killing him. Mm. You always got to be very aware of what's happening and understand that certain people, especially criminals, inmates, have motivations. If they're nice to you, why are they being nice to you? If they're kissing your ass, why are they kissing your ass? You know, hey, Officer Alexis, man, you look good today. What's that cologne, man? I need to get some of that when I get out, man. My girl would love it.
Yeah.
They're saying shit like that. It's like, what the fuck's going on? You know? And if they stop you and say, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? You know, look around to see what other people are doing.
Well, that's really interesting that, you know, that you decided to go through this career, you know, because I think a lot of the average person really wouldn't want to, you know, be a corrections officer. So
I think that if you're in a good facility with a good support system that still has benefits and a decent retirement, it's not a bad career. But if you have a shitty supervisor and you have no support system, or if you have a supervisor that takes the sides of inmates or has favorite inmates, man, get a new career.
Yeah, how common is that?
It's not very common, but I've had supervisors that would go out and hang out in the tier with the inmates. And one of the inmates that this person was friends with had a tattoo of a correctional officer with the Utah State Prison uniform, and the cartoon was the officer was a pig and he was getting his throat slit.
Wow.
And the inmate's nickname was Tennessee.
That's
yeah.
He got that tattoo in prison, right?
I don't know where the inmate got the tattoo.
Interesting.
But I mean, it's like, well, he's still a human being. He's still, it's like, but I mean, I don't mind joking around with inmates. I will joke with them all day long and keep them amused. I'll be more likely to do it with, say, mentally ill inmates than I would in maximum security.
Yeah.
It's just, there's different populations. There's some guys that I didn't get along with at all. You know, they see the badge and they hate my guts.
But so they already have that preconceived.
Yeah. Yeah, you're a fucking cop. Fuck yeah. You. You're authority. You know, I don't want to hear anything you want to fucking say. Just tell me why you're here. It's like, okay, well, whatever.
You've lived a pretty long life so far. What would you...
Are you calling me old?
No.
You've lived a long fucking life, man. You're 51.
I mean, a lot longer than I have, for sure.
I'm a lot older than you.
Yeah. If you could go back in time, what would be one piece of advice that you would give yourself?
I guess stop and smell the roses. Probably what I would tell myself is... enjoy the moment. Stop chasing certain levels in life. Stop saying, well, life will begin once I become a police officer. Well, life will begin after I'm done with the academy. Well, life will begin when I achieve this or when I achieve that. Stop chasing things. Stop and enjoy the moment you're in with the people that you're with. Relish those moments, because at some point you're going to look back and say, God, I really wish I had taken more time to appreciate that moment. I look back and I've had so many amazing experiences in my life. but I was so concerned about the next step, the next level of success, that I did not enjoy the moment. I look back and I think of all the things that I have done, and I've got some really unique, crazy, fun experiences, but I was so worried about that next thing that I didn't relish the moment.
Would you say that, you know, that's some of your biggest regrets? That's where some of them come from?
Well, you know, John and I, we talked about this in the podcast multiple times, and that is, don't live with regret. And John talks about, you know, his background with his disability with hearing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going to meet Lou Ferrigno at Comic-Con in Salt Lake City, and don't let this experience pass you by. He was debating whether or not to go. And we talk about, don't live with regret. Don't let this moment pass you by, and don't live with regret. Regret's horrible, I think. If a certain experience presents itself, or opportunity presents itself, and I'm not talking like robbing a bank or doing a line of coke off a hooker's ass, I'm not talking about those sort of opportunities, I'm talking about, don't wait, because tomorrow's never guaranteed. You know, live life to the fullest within your means. Like, oh, I've never, you know, blown $5,000 at the casino that I don't have in the bank. Well, that's not really a good thing to do. Regret is probably one of the worst things. And I look back and I say to myself, well, do I have regret on this, or should I have done this, or should I have done that? Moving forward, I say to myself, you know, if I'm on the fence, as long as it's fiscally feasible and responsible and I could still do it, don't pass up these opportunities. Don't live with regret. Enjoy life to the fullest. But it might be something as simple as, like, somebody that, you know, you haven't seen for years, and they call you and it's like, hey, let's go out to dinner. I'm in town and I'm visiting and I'm only here for tonight. And you're like, oh, I'm tired, or I really don't want to go out and have that experience. Go out and, you know, catch up with that old friend. Regret is just a horrible thing. Don't live with regret. Definitely. We've talked about that. Do I have regrets in life? I'm sure I do.
But you try not to focus on them, right?
I try not to focus on them. I'm trying to think of regret that I have, and I can't really, you know, at this moment in my life, I can't really think that I have regrets. You know, there's probably things, you know, Alexis, where I could say, the prop collecting. I told you I'd sold everything in 2007, and I eliminated everything, and 3 years later, I was mad, and I started collecting again. So there are certain pieces I wish I'd never sold. I'll never own them again. Or the chances of me owning them again are very slim. And so there is that element. But I don't think that's as much regret anymore, because as I'm getting older, at some point, I will either sell my current collection or give it away, or somebody will inherit it when I pass away. Mm-hmm. But it's just stuff. It's really not that important. It's not like a human being or a life or the time you get to spend with the people that you love.
That piece of advice was something that a lot of people should take.
It's also part of, like, you know, being young. You start to learn this stuff as you get older.
Yeah.
You start to look back and say, God, why was I so hung up on that car or that guitar or skateboard or movie prop? It's really not important. What's important is the people around you, the ones that you love, the experiences that you have with your friends and family.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I think this will be the last question.
Okay.
you could be remembered for one thing. What would that thing be?
Ooh. I think if there was one thing that I wish, or I would hope that I would be remembered for, is integrity. Doing what's right, regardless of who is watching you. I would hope that once I'm gone, people would say, what you see is what you get with Mark. And when I talk about, this ties in to what we were talking about with regret. Mm-hmm. And this was really, really important to me. And I talk about this in another podcast episode. And I apologize to somebody because they had an attraction for me and I was not honest and I wasn't authentic about who I was with sexuality. I look back and I see certain women that were attracted to me. And of course I was in the closet and I wasn't ready to come out. And so they had attraction to me and I had rejected them. And I know they're questioning their own validity, their own beauty, their own, like, why does he not like me? Mm-hmm. And if I had been honest and authentic, and if I had said, if I'd had the courage, again, it was a different time period, but it's something I wrestled with for years. If I had been authentic and I just said, look, I'm gay, I'm attracted to men, then that would have made them have no self-doubt about themselves. And I guess the whole process has taught me about why it's so important to be honest and authentic and have integrity. And it takes courage to say, look, I'm gay. It's not about you. You're a wonderful person. And if I was straight, I would absolutely love to be in a relationship with you, have children, whatever. But it has nothing to do with you. Mm-hmm. And it's something that bothered me for years. And at one point, I even dated a woman for, I think, like a year. And it was miserable because there was not an attraction there. You know, having sex, it was not very comfortable. And I was living a complete lie. I was not being authentic. I wasn't being real. And I wasn't being honest. And I look back and it's, I can't help but say it's one of those regrets in life. And if I had been honest and real, there would have been less heartache for that person. I wouldn't put them through what I put them through. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's probably the one thing that I would hope that I would be remembered for is integrity, honesty.
Did you ever get a chance to like make things better with that certain person or even people?
I never talked with the one that I'm referring to that I was in a relationship with. That person went on to date other people. And then I got into a relationship and she saw who I was with. I think she's a brilliant woman and she, I'm sure, connected the dots. It mm-hmm. would have been nice to sit down and clear the air. I can't go into the details of, like, you know, why things worked out like that. It's out of my control. I would love to sit down and have that conversation. It's kind of like one of those situations where it became bygones be bygones. We see each other in passing, hope all is well. A lot of it is, you know, the similar personalities, us both being Leos, if you're into the astrological sign thing, but we are definitely personality types. They probably wouldn't have worked. If I was straight, it wouldn't have worked. There's no way it would have worked because we were way too similar in personality type. So,
yeah. This has been Alex, your host for this week's Gay Florida Man podcast, and I'm going to close out today telling you the same thing we tell you every week. Be good, and if you can't be good at it. And if you're sitting in prison, you're not good at it. Good night, everyone. Thank you.